Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, on this Tuesday, March 15th. And today we're going to learn about some of the fantastic marine mammal community and education work happening on the islands. First, we will talk with Christy West, Associate Professor of Biology at the Hawaii Pacific University. Christy, are you calling it? Are you with us?
Yes. Hi, Carly.
Hi, Christy. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So now, first tell us a little bit about this marine mammal stranding network that you work with and how you got involved.
Sure. So our role at HPU is actually the cause of death investigations and responding when dead marine mammals show up on our shores or floating at sea. And we're part of kind of a bigger marine mammal stranding network here in the region that is really coordinated by the NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service, Pacific Islands Regional Office, and we end up working with a number of different partners in this initiative, and that includes the state and nonprofits and community members and, of course, the public that reports that we have a distressed or a dead marine mammal.
Well, so there's quite a few people then involved in this network.
Absolutely. Big community effort across all of our islands, and it really does just start at the level of our ocean users, because most of our reports come from people that are fishing, surfing, swimming, walking the beach, and it is really important that people report animals that are stranded dead as soon as possible. Sometimes I don't know if people realize that. They may think that, you know, potentially no one cares, but the reality is that the sooner we have the ability to recover a carcass, the more information that we are ultimately going to learn from it, and the fresher it is, the more we'll be able to tell what happened to it and what brought it up on the shore. So really like to get that message out there that we do care, and we rely heavily on the public to let us know.
So I'm not sure everybody really knows what happens when a marine mammal strands. So from someone identifying a stranded marine animal or a marine mammal carcass, and they call the network, what happens after that? What's sort of the process involved there?
An animal that's called in, any animal that's suspected to be not just dead on our shores, but also in distress, we have a process of really dispatching that report to the partners that are going to take action for any given type of stranding or, you know, depending which type of marine mammals involved. So a different group, for example, would respond to monk seals than our group at HPU that responds to dead whales and dolphins. But if we get a call of a suspected dead whale or dolphin on the shores, it involves sending out a team of first responders that are going to assess that this really, in fact, is a dead dolphin or whale, questions that we're going to be asking the people that are on site and trying to determine as we send out a team are, you know, how big is this animal? Because we all know that a humpback whale is many, many times bigger and logistically more challenging to deal with on a beach than, say, a small spinner dolphin. So questions that initially are answered is, what is this size? Will we need heavy equipment? Is it accessible? Is it in a safe area? Maybe it's in a surf zone and there's a lot of tiger sharks around it and that wouldn't be a safe retrieval. So the initial process is seeing if we can safely remove that carcass, and if we can, then we carry out the human equivalent of an autopsy, which is called a necropsy for animals, and the goal of that is to determine why that animal died. We also collect a number of different samples that we use for research, since many of our species here of dolphins and whales are really poorly known in Hawaii.
And you said time is of the essence. If a certain amount of time goes by where the whale has a dead whale carcass has already been washed ashore, is it not viable, or can you not do a necropsy after a certain amount of time?
We cannot do a full necropsy after a certain amount of time, and I would say that if an animal has been on our shores for several weeks, and that can happen in some of these remote areas before, say, someone in the public sees this animal and reports it, we would we're very likely in that situation to be able to determine cause of death. However, even if an animal has been dead for many, many weeks, they are still valuable to us for some of the research investigations. So to give you an example, almost everything we know about what dolphins and whales eat comes from stomach content remains, because these animals do their foraging deep below the surface. It's not something we can observe. And we can collect stomach content remains. We can identify hard parts like squid beaks to the exact species of squid and the size of that squid from an animal that may have been in a remote area on the rocks dead for many weeks. So we would still want to have those reports, even though we may not be able to determine the cause of death for that individual.
Yeah, well, that definitely seems important. So I guess a broader question then is, why do marine mammals strand? Do we know why they're washing up ashore, or why they get into trouble sometimes?
So many reasons could be responsible for any specific marine mammal stranding event. There really isn't just one or two things that we can point to. And that's a lot of why we do, of course, the work that we do, is to try to determine here in Hawaii what is it that brings our animals to shore. And just to give you an example of a few of the different things that we have seen or may be looking for that could contribute to stranding events, we do have many different marine mammals that strand here due to different diseases. So we see different types of bacterial infections or viruses or fungal disease. We've had animals that have stranded with very, very heavy parasite burdens. We've had animals that have stranded with up to 30 pounds of marine debris and plastics in their stomachs. We've had entangled dolphins. Underwater noise is a possibility. Vessel strikes is a possibility. So lots of different things may be responsible, and that's, of course, what we're trying to figure out with each and every individual event.
So it's kind of like CSI for marine mammal world, huh?
Yes, whale CSI, that's us.
Perfect. And the causes for strandings that we see in Hawaii, is that common elsewhere in the world, or are some of these issues particular to the Hawaiian Islands?
I think that most of these, I just mentioned that kind of long list of things we look for, and you know, many of those things we've seen here. And I would say that over time we'll be able to compare that better to, you know, what do our trends look like compared to other regions? And we've actually been doing this for 10 years now.
Wow.
2016 is our 10th year. So we're actually hoping at this juncture to really do some of that analysis and kind of take a look at which are the most prevalent here in Hawaii, and then how does this compare to other areas. So just kind of building that database. And, you know, it has a component here of monitoring, because if we can determine what our baseline prevalences of these different causes, then it'll be a lot easier to see that, hey, this is going up, or, you know, luckily this is being mitigated. So really valuable data collection over the years is a part of this process.
Excellent. Well, we're glad to have you guys here and doing this work for the last 10 years. What about the marine mammals we have here? Are they unique to Hawaii? Are they fairly common species? And do we have any endangered whale species here?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we all know that there's many unique things about Hawaii, and certainly our populations of different marine mammals fall into that category. So when we look at the mainland United States and stranding networks there, they tend to respond to really just a handful or a couple of different dolphin and whale species with each call. And so when their phone rings, they pretty much know usually, okay, it's this type of dolphin or this type of dolphin. And when our phone rings, it's the opposite. So we have about 20 different species of dolphins and whales in our waters. And most people, I think, are really familiar with the humpback whale and the spinner dolphin, but don't realize that there's about 18 other species out there that are much less well known. And when we have a stranding, it could be any one of them. So it's a really unique opportunity here to have such diversity in our whales and dolphins that come ashore. And we do have endangered marine mammals here, the humpback whale, the sperm whale, and also the false killer whale. We have a resident population with less than 200 individuals remaining of false killer whales, and those do strand on our shores. We actually had one at South Point on the Big Island in November and learned a lot from that individual about threats and things that you know, our false killer whales are up against.
And has there ever been a whale stranding or a particular necropsy that you've worked on where it's really stumped you, or something that's been particularly unique about that particular stranding?
Yeah, I think we had a stranding several years ago that I kind of refer to as what can one whale tell us story. And that refers to a really heroic effort on Maui, and we had a report of a dead whale in Hana, and it was an animal that weighed well over 1,000 pounds, so not easy and logistically unchallenging to deal with. And we had incredible support from many partners on Maui, and they actually brought in heavy equipment, put this whale in the back of a pickup truck, and drove it from Hana to the Kahului Airport at night. So that shirt that we see that says, "I survived the road to Hana," has new meaning for those that must have been driving that pickup truck. But it turns out that specific whale was the longman's beaked whale, which is the second most poorly known whale in the world, and was only the 10th confirmed stranding of a longman's beaked whale worldwide in over 100 years.
Wow.
And we learned so much from that individual. We actually did the most extensive investigation that had ever been done for a longman's beaked whale, and it turns out that whale actually died from morbillivirus, and that's a virus that is a serious threat to marine mammal populations in other parts of the world, but we actually didn't know that it was here in Hawaii. We actually thought we were maybe free of it, until we found that longman's beaked whale, in fact, died of that virus. And so that is obviously now a threat that has been identified for these waters. We're watching for it. We're monitoring it. But I think that's a really good example of what one whale can tell us if everybody comes together like everyone did with that Maui case. They're never easy, right? Hana, Maui. Needed to be driven at night, needed to be transported to Oahu. But we really learned a lot from such a poorly known animal that it can be looked at as an opportunity to learn from an unfortunate event.
Now, morbillivirus has been brought up again, time and time again, not just with whales and dolphins, but with monk seals as well. Why is it such a concern with regards to marine mammals?
So that specific virus seems to have the potential to hit a naive population of marine mammals and result in mass mortality. And the most probably recent mass mortality associated with it is the 2013 to 2014 event off of the east coast of the United States, and I believe that the count of bottlenose dolphins that died from morbillivirus in that event exceeded 1,200 dolphins. So the worry with morbillivirus is obviously very great when we know that it has that kind of potential for mass mortality. And we know that it is in our Hawaiian waters, being that it did cause the death of that longman's beaked whale. We have not seen mass mortality here. Of course, yet another reason why we are monitoring all of these drowning events so that we can hopefully be ahead of some sort of outbreak like that. So I don't think it's cause for extreme concern, but yet it pays to be cautionary. And, of course, I think that's some of the thought process behind trying our best to know, to take our knowledge of knowing that threat is here and then protect our Hawaiian monk seals as well as, of course, hopefully our other marine mammals as well.
Sure. And when you're doing these necropsies and learning so much from the animals, what type of research or information are you gathering when you're doing your necropsies?
So we're certainly gathering information on cause of death and the various causes of mortality and how prevalent they may be, and, of course, which types of diseases are responsible for stranding events in these waters, and how does this compare with other regions. But in addition to that work, we have a lot of work on just the biology and how these animals make their living that we look into with this rare opportunity to study these animals up close and personal. And so an example of that is the diet work. As I mentioned, almost everything we know about what our various species of dolphins and whales eat comes from stomach content remains from stranding. Another example is we look at myoglobin levels and acid buffering capacity in the muscle tissue because we have these animals that are incredibly deep divers, and they can swim at tremendous speeds and push their bodies to these extremes that, you know, we can't do. And so just trying to understand better how it is that they can make living in the ocean work so successfully for them.
Absolutely. And do you see any trends in the strandings? Are they happening more frequently in certain locations or certain islands?
That is a good question, and we have some complicating factors. So the most frequent reports of strandings come in on Oahu. However, this is the island with the highest population density, and we rely on public reporting. So perhaps there really are more strandings on Oahu. Perhaps we find out about more strandings on Oahu. Over time, I think similar trends. We are seeing more strandings over time. But, of course, we are hoping that people will report strandings, and we are hoping that people will help us to look, you know, into what caused the death of these animals. And I would think that maybe 20 years ago, the public may not have been so aware that this would be something that people would care about. So the increased reporting, or it may be increased reporting as opposed to increased stranding events.
Right. And I guess that brings us to the million-dollar question. You know, in terms of educating the public, what should someone do if they come across a stranded animal? What advice would you like to give the public?
To please call, it's a NOAA hotline number, and that begins the whole process of dispatching the appropriate trained responders to investigate the event. And I'll just give you that number on the air, but people can obviously, probably the quickest is to just Google it and, you know, report a stranded marine mammal in Hawaii. But that number is a 1-888-256-9840.
Okay. And we'll share that as well on our website, Christy. We want that number out there and having people to call. And if the community wants to get more involved, are there volunteer networks or positions with the strandings or other marine mammal work that you do?
Yeah, we do rely heavily on volunteers. We cannot do this work without volunteers. And I think just when you think of the sheer size of some of these whales that we investigate, probably pretty easy to imagine that this really takes an incredibly large team. And so, yes, by all means, if there's people that are interested in this forensic side of things, we would love to hear from them. And probably the best way to reach us is through is online, and it's going to be through HPU. And if they look up the HPU stranding program, then they can probably reach out to us that way. We have a email as well, which is just stranding@hpu.edu.
Excellent. And you're not just working with the community. You do a lot of work with students as well.
Oh, absolutely. So we rely very, very heavily on our students, and obviously great opportunity for hands-on learning for them. But we could not respond without our students that we really can count on and that go alongside with all of this work.
Excellent. And Christy, when you're not dealing with strandings, which hopefully is not all the time, what else do you do with your work and this vast amount of knowledge and research that you have in your tool belt?
Well, you do understand that they come in 365 days a year, all hours of the day and night. So it does feel like we respond to strandings all of the time, but I also teach classes at HPU. I teach in the biology program. I teach in the marine biology program. I have 3 children, so life is busy.
Wow, that's an amazing balancing act and such rewarding work. I really appreciate you taking some time to share your experiences with us and information. So one more time, what's that stranding hotline number that everyone should commit to memory?
Yes, absolutely. So the stranding hotline number to report a distressed or dead stranded marine mammal is 1-888-256-9840.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Christy. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we're going to talk more marine mammals and education.
With cheese baked into the shell, Taco Bell's quesalupa is going to be big. How big?
Bigger than Drew Delivery!
Cheese in the shell? This is going to be bigger than Duckface.
I say this is going to be bigger than the election.
My opponent is so wrong. It's going to be bigger than the election.
Cheese in the shell? This is going to be bigger than 3D printing. In 6 hours, I'll have a keychain.
The Quesalupa, with delicious melty pepper jack cheese baked into the shell. People think it's going to be bigger than almost everything. Only at Taco Bell. At participating locations for a limited time while supplies last.
Millions of people have switched to Sprint this past year. To celebrate, we're extending our 50% off promotion so you don't have to miss out. Switch to Sprint today and save 50% off most Verizon, AT&T, or T-Mobile rate plans for a limited time only. And now, you can save $200 instantly when you get the Samsung Galaxy Note 5 or Galaxy S6 and trade in your working smartphone. All this on the Sprint network, which is faster, more reliable, and has better coverage than ever. So why wouldn't you switch today? This special offer is available for a limited time only. So hurry in. Visit a Sprint store or Sprint.com to learn more.
Claim based on Sprint's analysis of average LTE download speeds using Nielsen and MP data. Speeds may vary. Offer coverage not available everywhere. Excludes taxes, surcharges, add-on, and premium content. Subject to new line port activation fee and credit. See website for eligible plans. Savings until 2018 after pay full amount. Requires trade-in of current working smartphone. Limit one per line. Restrictions apply.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal, and today we are looking at some of the local marine mammal programs here in Hawaii. Moving away from strandings, we are now joined by Nicole West, who has been working with Dolphin Quest Oahu as a supervisor of marine animals since 1999. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. I know you must be a very busy girl, but first, let's start. Tell me a little bit about Dolphin Quest.
Sure. Well, Dolphin Quest was started by two world-renowned marine mammal vets who actually wanted to take people out of the stands and get people into the water, into the animals' environment, and really meet them up close and personal so that, you know, that close interaction really inspires people and connects people to nature. And that's the whole vision of what Dolphin Quest is about.
And how did you first start with Dolphin Quest?
Well, you know, I was really blessed. I actually got hired on as one of the first few people here at the Oahu facility. So, yeah, that's my story. But people who want to get involved in this field, really the best thing to do is to volunteer or do internships with places like this. A degree is really important as well. And of course, a passion and a love of animals is also very important.
And how did you first get involved with the animal care and the training that you do, I guess, at Dolphin Quest and maybe beforehand?
Sure. Well, you know, growing up, I actually didn't have pets. And so my love and affinity for animals started the first time I went to a zoo and got to see animals that you wouldn't normally see in your house right there in front of me. And so that's where my passion started. And, of course, pursuing different fields, working with animals was something that I did. And then got to have the ultimate dream job of working with Dolphin Quest. So, yeah, I'm very blessed.
And at Dolphin Quest Oahu, how many dolphins do you have in your facility, and what does a typical day look like for you? I'm sure it's pretty busy.
Sure, absolutely. So we care for 6 common bottlenose dolphins, and every day starts with actually sorting over 100 pounds of restaurant-quality certified sustainable fish. It gets hand-inspected and then individualize into each animal's daily breakout. And then there's a lot of cleaning. There's actually a ton of cleaning. We want to make sure that the animal's environment and everything in it is kept clean and up to the highest standards. There's a lot of record keeping as well. I mean, we keep records of everything we do, from how much each animal is getting of fish to the water quality. So there's a lot of record keeping. You know, our standards actually exceed the government standards for care for these guys, and really at any time we can be inspected by the USDA. Something else that we do every day, of course, to educate and speak with guests about Dolphin Quest, who we are, and of course about the animals that they're meeting or even watching on the side of the lagoon. And then from there, absolutely nothing is typical. I mean, every day we try to make things variable, and we do that with different types of interactions and novel training sessions, medical training, lots of play and research. And our goal every day is to make today look nothing like yesterday. That's pretty challenging for sure.
I bet. It sounds like there's a lot of different components between cleaning and diet and enrichment. What other types of animal training and care do you include in your daily day-to-day with the dolphins?
Well, you know, including everything I talked about, their care, it's a lot of just training them to participate in their own health care. So all of our animals are trained to provide us any samples that we may need to, you know, diagnose or assess their health. We train them for a lot of the research that we're involved in. We train them to really have fun and play with guests. I mean, that's a huge part of our day too, is just interacting and meeting guests as well.
And how often are the animals examined, and what are you looking for in terms of health and care when you are examining the animals?
Well, every day we do what's called a daily dolphin assessment, and that's basically just looking at the animal from the tip of their mouth to the end of their tail flukes, looking at their whole body, looking at their body condition. We also are looking at their appetite, their eyes, their energy level, and that information then gets sent out to all of our veterinarians and in a report. And as well as, you know, every time we're interacting with them, we're looking at them, we're assessing them. And what we're looking for is just anything unusual, anything out of the ordinary. And then also once a month, our contract veterinarian, he comes and does his own examination on each animal and reviews their records and meets with the behaviorist staff.
Excellent. And what happens if an animal gets sick or if you find something that's different or something that's going wrong with an animal?
Sure. You know, one of the most amazing things about having these guys and knowing them so well is that we can just find the slightest thing. We would notice anything even slightly off baseline with these animals. And so then what do? Well, we collect any samples that we need through that cooperative training that we do with them, that voluntary medical training that we do. And so we collect the samples, and that helps get a diagnostic view of whatever may be going on with them. And then, of course, that information is sent out to the veterinarians, and they're in the loop of every step of the way of what's happening with the animals. And the veterinarians are a text, an email, or a phone call away. And so they're in the loop, and they decide what to do next, if anything. If what we saw behaviorally was warranted or not, they will handle it from there and have us treat it as necessary.
Interesting. And we just talked with Christy West from HBU. We're talking about the Marine Mammal Stranding Program here in Hawaii and what can be learned from this program. What can we learn from the animals in captivity that you work with the dolphins there? And does this information transfer to marine mammals in the wild?
Absolutely, absolutely. And actually, we've done work with Dr. Christy West, and yeah, we've worked very closely with her. You know, a lot of what we know from animals, actually about the animals, comes from animals in professional care. Me personally, I mean, I love training for research because it has far-reaching impacts. I mean, what we're collecting, the data we're collecting today, it's going to have impact us years down the road and really hopefully work towards making, you know, new laws and great ways to protect the animals out in the wild. I mean, Dolphin Quest firmly believes in research, and to date we have supported research through funds and resources in the likes of over $3.5 million. And so we fully support research. And in fact, what we're collecting when we collect research is baseline data. And this information many times would just simply be impossible to collect from animals in the wild. And so we truly are, you know, helping not just the animals in our care, but the animals out in the wild for sure.
And what role does your dolphin program play in the education, research, and interaction programs that you have?
Well, it's a pivotal one, really. You know, people come and they meet dolphins, and they are in awe of them, and they are inspired, and it's just the most amazing thing to get to be a part of every day, to have a person touch a dolphin for the first time and just be awestruck. And we, you know, and then we like to encourage them and talk about the animals out in the wild who may not have things so easy as our animals do. And we like to make that connection when they're interacting with the animals, and hopefully that inspiration that they're feeling then goes out and translates into actions that, you know, they can do in their own homes. And so having dolphins in our care, we could certainly talk, and you and I could talk, but having a dolphin right there in front of them, it just brings a whole nother dynamic to guests and really to education. Without our dolphin programs, we wouldn't have been able to contribute to all the research that we have over the last three decades as well. So, you know, having dolphins and doing our interactions is a pivotal part of our ability to reach everyone, really.
Yeah, and I know you, Dolphin Quest has been involved in quite a bit of research and education. I believe Cami's going to come on and talk about that in a minute here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about some of the concerns that have been raised about marine mammals in captivity and in captive facilities? How does Dolphin Quest respond to these concerns?
Well, you know, thank you for asking. You know, we welcome those questions and concerns, and we encourage anyone to come and visit us and see what we do firsthand. I mean, I've had people who have shared that they weren't sure, and then they're like, wow, we see what you do. Clearly, you folks are doing a phenomenal job. And you know, we appreciate people who think about the welfare of animals, because really that's what we live. And everyone who works for Dolphin Quest, we are the true animal advocates. And so, you know, it's clear when you come and you spend some time around the lagoon, it's really clear that their health and well-being is our top priority. And, you know, Carly, one of my most favorite compliments that I get and that I've gotten over the years is when a guest will come and stop by the office or pull me aside and say, wow, I can really tell that you love your animals and that they are well-loved and cared for. And they seem to love you back. I mean, to me, that says it all. That really, really says it all. And that's certainly, we love hearing that.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear that. That's great. What about the locations that you're working on? I know you're based in Oahu, but does Dolphin Quest have other locations here in Hawaii or elsewhere in the world?
Yeah, so there's three Dolphin Quest locations. There is the one on Oahu at the beautiful Kahala Hotel and Resort. And then we have one on the Big Island at the Hilton Waikoloa Village. And then we also have one in Bermuda as well.
Wow, okay. So a little bit in the Caribbean, a little bit here. And how did the facilities differ from each other?
You know, each location, their programs vary just slightly here and there, maybe with what you do or for how long you are interacting or other activities besides just meeting the dolphins. But all of the programs, no matter what program you're in, you'll get to learn about the dolphins up close and personal. You'll get to feed them and, of course, have lots of fun. That's consistent in every location.
That's great. And when you talked a lot about enrichment for the animals and training the dolphins, do they learn new things as they go, or are you sort of working with the same training and same procedures with them?
Great question. You know, I hope to never stop learning, and that's what we provide for our animals as well. We believe that training is teaching, and of course, learning is enriching. And so, you know, as long as we have these animals in our care, we're going to continue to find new ways to stimulate them mentally, engage their minds, and provide the most dynamic and motivating environment. And really, we can do that through training. And we'll never stop training them. We're always trying to think of new fun ways to games or puzzles for them to do. So, yeah, we love doing that. And, you know, there's still so much to be learned also about these animals in the wild and even the animals in our care. And so we're going to always find ways to support answering those questions that we'll continue to have about them as we learn more.
And I have to ask, do you have a favorite?
Oh, goodness. I've worked with Hoku the longest. I worked with him for 16 years, and I was his primary trainer for some of his medical training early on. So certainly he has an extra special place in my heart. But you know what? They're so, so different, and they're so individual that it's like you love them for their uniqueness. It's like asking a parent which kid is your favorite.
Well, my parents would say me.
Well, I think I'm their favorite trainer, so, you know.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, Nicole, thank you so much for your enthusiasm and sharing a little bit of your experiences with us. We want to talk more about Dolphin Quest conservation and education programs. We're going to take a quick traffic break. Thanks so much, Nicole.
Thank you. Take care.
This is the sound of a University of Phoenix student earning a business degree. What you don't hear is the University of Phoenix student studying in between shifts, in his two-bedroom apartment, while his children sleep. What you don't hear is this student defying the odds to succeed. Shouldn't that student be the candidate you take a longer look at? University of Phoenix. We rise. Learn more at phoenix.edu.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice.
What if something happens? Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of a terrorist attack.
Mom, if you're not home,
should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal. Last, but certainly not least, we have Cameron Dabney with us. Cammy is the Regional Education Supervisor for Dolphin Quest and oversees the education, outreach, and conservation programs for both Oahu and the Big Island. Cammy's been an active member of Hawaii's marine community for over a decade. Cammy, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
So glad you could join us. You're calling in from Waikoloa, is that correct?
Yep, from the Big Island.
Excellent. How's the weather over there today?
Oh, it's great, as usual.
Fabulous.
Glad to have the trade winds back.
Yeah. So we were able to talk with Nicole a little bit about Dolphin Quest, but maybe you could share a little bit more about the history and how Dolphin Quest evolved here on the islands.
Well, sure. Hopefully I don't repeat too much of what Nicole said, but you know, basically, Dolphin Quest started in 1988 here on the Big Island. And we're owned by two marine mammal veterinarians, Dr. Ray Stone and Dr. Jay Sweeney. And the whole premise, the idea behind Dolphin Quest was to create a place where people can interact in a fun and safe environment, you know, with dolphins to learn about them. And then also for our purposes to support science, research, conservation, and our education. So we want to be able to, you know, show our guests and teach people about our dolphins, and then also take what we, you know, take that science, that data that we can get, and apply that to helping animals out in the wild.
So Nicole talked a lot about the training program, but I'm really interested in the education programs and some of the broader work that you guys do at Dolphin Quest.
Okay. Well, I think you'd be actually a really good example for multiple reasons. One, you've been one of our funded researchers, and you just brought your grandma to Dolphin Quest just recently. Did you have fun when you were here?
Yeah, my grandma really enjoyed that experience and was, I think, great for her being in Canada. You know, she doesn't get really that up close too often. Now, do you do education programs with just the tourists coming in, or do you work with the community as well?
We work with everyone. I mean, obviously, we're very popular with tourists because most people who love dolphins and want to learn more about them, especially can come to Hawaii. We have all the, you know, we have the wild spinner dolphins off the coast, and then off we also have, you know, our dolphins here. So we do get a lot of tourism, but we also offer a whole array of programs for the local community. One of the biggest ones that we do for on both the Oahu and the Big Island sites is our school programs. So we've had about almost 4,000 kids come through Dolphin Quest in the past year to come learn about the ocean and marine life and then to meet the dolphins. And here on the Big Island, with the school program specifically, each grade level is catered to state and national science standards and then also ocean literacy principles. And so teachers can come, bring their classes. They're really inexpensive for the kids. We want to make sure that everybody can participate. And we focus on STEM in every program. And we add conservation into every module, every activity that we do. So, for example, our fifth graders are learning about cetaceans, dolphins and whales, some of their taxonomy, and then how plastic can actually affect those animals. And then other are like preschoolers and kindergartens are learning about tide pools. Our first and second graders are learning about life cycles. The third and fourth graders are learning about food webs. We talk a lot about the monk seal in that one and the false killer whales here off the Big Island. And then for older kids, we have an array where we can cater it more towards careers or conservation, science, things like that. So it's a pretty dynamic program where we reach out to thousands of kids all throughout the state.
And so is it mostly middle and elementary school, or are you working at the high school level as well?
We have several high school classes coming. One of the cool things, too, is we have visiting high schoolers who come to the Big Island for different programs, and so they'll come year after year and bring some of their students to come join us and learn about the ecology of the species here in Hawaii.
Excellent.
We also have a pretty good partnership with the University of Hawaii, both at Manoa and at Hilo.
I was going to say, so you're working with a really broad range of students from, you know, preschool to all the way up to college, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Do you work with the community as well outside of classrooms?
Of course. We're always doing fun outreach events, and you'll see us a lot of the things, marine activities out there. One of the upcoming events we have on Oahu is actually the North Shore Ocean Fest on June 4th at Turtle Bay. So we'll have a booth up there. And then here on the Big Island, we're going to be celebrating Earth Hour, which is on March 19th. So we'll have a little ocean expo here at the Hilton. So we're active, you know, in our community. We work very closely with other marine mammal organizations. We have a great partnership with Ke Kaiola, which is the monk seal hospital in Kona. We provide fish for those animals. Right now they have 7 cute little monk seal patients right there. They were rescued and getting rehabilitated now, hopefully being released soon. And then we also provide in-kind support. So a lot of our trainers and educators will go down to the hospital and volunteer there as well.
Excellent. And I'm not sure if you got to hear, but we had Christy West from HPU on the show earlier before talking about the Stranding Network. Mm-hmm. Does Dolphin Quest get involved with any of these efforts?
Yes, definitely. We're involved with both the Stranding Network and the Disentanglement Network. That's the NOAA's Large Whale Disentanglement Network. With Christy, we are involved with her in several ways. One, she's another one of our researchers that we financially support. And then, of course, we support her in the field as well, with many of our staff members going out and doing some of the stranding work. And then just recently, what we started doing is partnering with Christy and NOAA to actually host stranding trainings at our learning center here on the Big Island. So their volunteers can actually come to Dolphin Quest. We'll do a classroom training session, and then we actually get those volunteers in the water with our animals so they can get some hands-on experience on learning how to feel for a dolphin's heartbeat, monitor the breath, look at the eyes, read the body language, feel what it feels like to, you know, hold a really healthy, live, big animal so they can get some experience. Because oftentimes in a stranding situation, it will be your first time working around a large animal, so by getting in the water and feeling a healthy animal, it will help give them a better idea.
And where would you go to find the heartbeat on a dolphin, just out of curiosity?
Right in between the pectoral flippers. If you give a dolphin a really big hug, you can feel it. It's really powerful. It's a really cool thing. It's right in the middle of their chest.
Excellent. Really, that's a really helpful tip to know. And you also participate in other types of marine mammal research as well. What, besides the stranding network, what else is Dolphin Quest doing?
Well, we have several projects all throughout the world. One of the biggest studies that we're doing is actually in Sarasota in Florida. And we significantly provide financial support for that research project. It's actually the longest running wild dolphin project study in the world. So they're doing a population study on those nearshore bottlenose dolphins there. And in Hawaii, we work very closely with the Cascadia Research Collective and Robin Baird. And so they come out to Hawaii several times a year to do population studies on all of the Hawaiian odontocetes, so all the toothed whales in Hawaii. So it would be like spinner dolphins, sperm whales, false killer whales, all of the melon-headed whales, all those kind of animals.
And the population studies, maybe we could get into a little bit more detail about that. How do you assess a population? What are these researchers in Florida and Hawaii doing to better understand the populations?
I've had experience coming out on the boat with Robin here in Hawaii. I haven't done the Sarasota project, but others at Dolphin Quest have actually been able to go out there and do it. One of the first things that they do is photo ID the animals, going out in the boats, taking photos of as many animals as they possibly can find. One way you can identify a dolphin or whale is by looking at its dorsal fin. On the back of the dorsal fin, they have really unique grooves and ridges, and they're unique to only that animal. So kind of like our thumbprint is unique to us, if you take a picture of that dorsal fin and year after year you find that same animal, you'll know who it is. And let's say that same animal the next year has a baby with it, then you can determine if it's a female, right? And so they developed this massive catalog of all these dorsal fins and are able to track populations through that way. Robin, one of the other things that he does, he'll actually take biopsies from samples, too, so we can look at genetics. But that would be probably a better question for Robin to answer than me.
And we've actually had Robin out on the show previously a couple years ago. Now, you said you've had a chance to go out with Robin, Cami. How does that experience work? You've been in the marine community for many, many years. Doing all these different things, how has your time evolved with marine science and marine conservation?
To be honest, being able to go out on the boat with Robin and the Cascadia Research Collective was kind of a dream come true for me, especially studying marine mammals. I studied humpback whales in school, doing an acoustic study, and had always wanted to, A, meet Robin, and then definitely go out on the boat because they just see such an array of animals that you don't typically see by just going in a boat and kind of hanging offshore. I feel like he's got a sixth sense for finding these animals. And he's so knowledgeable and so passionate. And I, really have learned a lot from him and have been able to apply that in what I can teach here at Dolphin Quest and how to help wild dolphins, how we can help wild dolphins and, some of the conservation efforts that he has been able to put forth. His work with the false killer whales here has greatly impacted their being labeled as endangered. So that was huge. That's an insular population that we have off the Big Island, and some of the threats that they have are related to fishing. They eat mahi and ahi, similar fish that we do. So they have a really big overlap with some of the fishing gear and things like that. So you'll see a lot of injuries that way. So learning from Robin has just been great, and it's one of the cool things about working for Dolphin Quest is they really encourage you to go out and learn through experience, and those kind of opportunities they actually pay us to go out and help with the researchers here.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And the previous work you did with humpback whales and acoustics, do you guys do any acoustics works with the dolphins you have at Dolphin Quest?
I think Dolphin Quest has done some acoustic studies in the past with the Marine Mammal Research Program out at UH and Coconut Island. I don't believe we're doing any studies currently.
And you also have a history with UH then. Were you a marine option graduate, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. So we had Mackenzie Manning from the Marine Option Program last month on the show. And it's really nice to hear that Dolphin Quest is doing some work with Marine Option students. How does that feel for you being part of that program and now doing student mentorship with the students coming out of the program?
Oh, it's a great bridge. You know, one of the greatest things about MOP is experiential learning. That's their motto. They want you to get out in the field and experience through your senses, hands-on, touching, feeling, hearing, seeing. So being a MOP student, that was right up my alley because I learned way more by experiencing something than blindly Googling it or reading it in a book. You know, if I can see it or I can feel it or hear it, I learn it. And so I've been able to kind of apply that theory to what I'm doing here at Dolphin Quest as well. And I want, you know, I've always wanted to make that connection again and bring MOP students, also the pre-vet students at UH, to come to Dolphin Quest and get their hands on the dolphins, learn about the veterinarian sciences, the conservation efforts, things that they can do at home to make sure that we protect animals out in the wild.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's quite a large range there between your marine option students and the curriculum that you talked about earlier in the program. Are there other student-focused or career programs that Dolphin Quest offers?
Yeah, we do. We have opportunities for, you know, kids or teenagers, I should say, who are very interested in marine sciences or animal behavioral sciences, veterinary sciences, if they show a dedicated interest, then we want to cater to that because that's important. We want to offer programs for those types of students. So we've created some job shadow type opportunities, some mentorship opportunities, and then in Bermuda, we have a full internship program where students, college-level students, can go through and get hands-on experience as a trainer to hopefully fill into some of our programs in the future.
Excellent. And I know there's research grants that you guys do as well for students and for scientists as well in the community. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that program and how you decide to fund the research?
Well, to date, we have donated over $3.5 million to research. So it's a really significant portion of what we do. Luckily, the proceeds that we get from all of our programs go to our research in conservation, education, and obviously taking good care of the dolphins, right? So we have a research committee within the company, and we will look at all of the applications, all the grant applications that we get, and determine what the impact's going to be for either bettering our understanding of our dolphins and how to take care of them, or having a positive impact for wild dolphins and how we can better understand how to protect them. So we try to make sure that we align our research with what in those two goals.
Excellent. And how do people learn more about whether it's the education program or the research program or Dolphin Quest in general?
Well, the easiest way, you know, is going to our website. We have a lot of really good information on there. And just recently, we actually included a Hot Topics page. I kind of overheard you talking about some of the concerns with Nicole. You know, anytime dolphins and whales are involved, there's a lot of people who are interested and have, you know, a lot of opinions about it. So I would encourage people to go to the Hot Topics page and kind of learn more about Dolphin Quest and some of the initiatives that we're involved in. I think, like Nicole said, people are often very surprised once they get to know us and learn more about us and how they can get involved, basically. And then we're always, you know, we're very active in the community. We are consistently doing beach cleanups, and here on the Big Island, we have a stretch of highway where we do adopt a highway, so we have a lot of people who know us out there on the highway cleaning up. And we work very closely with Sustainable Coastlines, for example, and celebrate Marine Debris Month, and we're just pretty active in the community in that way, so getting out and seeing us. And the other cool thing that's really unique to Dolphin Quest is you can actually come to our sites. It's free. It's open to the public. You can just see the animals right there. You don't need a ticket or anything to come see the animals, so that's pretty unique. It's very rare nowadays.
That's fantastic.
That's probably the easiest way to learn about us, is come down and see us, talk to us.
Excellent. Well, it sounds like you guys have a lot going on in the community and a lot with your education program. So thank you for sharing a little bit about that with us. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank all my guests today for talking about marine mammal community work here in Hawaii. I'd like to thank everyone who took the time to talk today, and a special thanks to the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.